What happens when you've been wronged in the workplace? What do you do? Let's say you're one of the top performing employees. You have met all of the criteria for promotion and you speak very difficult foreign languages that you use at work literally every single day, but you're still passed over for promotion. And when you challenge it, you're told right to your face that you're being transferred to a less desirable position just because of the color of your skin. You file a complaint with Human Resources. After all, this kind of discrimination is patently illegal. But you've made trouble for the leadership, and this isn't just the leadership of some random company. This is the leadership of the Central Intelligence Agency. What happens next? Not only are you not promoted, not only are you not given the assignment that you had originally been given, but you're charged with multiple counts of espionage, and you face the prospect of spending the rest of your life in prison. I'm John Kiriakou, and you're watching The Whistleblowers. Today, we're going to tell you about the story of one of the most heroic whistleblowers in the American intelligence community. This is the story of Jeffrey Sterling, an accomplished CIA operations officer and expert on Iranian affairs. Jeffrey also happens to be African American. He joined the CIA in 1993, and after going through operational and Farsi language training, he was sent overseas to work on hard targets. He handled some of the most difficult cases in the CIA's Near Eastern Operations Division. But in 2000, he was passed over for promotion, and a supervisor intimated that Jeffrey could not have a plum assignment that he had already been given simply because he was black. He filed a racial discrimination lawsuit against the CIA, but instead of giving him his original assignment, apologizing, or trying to settle things quietly, the CIA used its nuclear option. We'll walk you through that story and tell you about one of the most resilient whistleblowers we know. Jeffrey Sterling, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Jeffrey, you and I were at the CIA at the same time. In that period, in the 1990s, the agency spent a great deal of time, energy, and money focusing on the Iranian nuclear program. You were trained in Iran operations, and you even learned to speak Farsi. You had success overseas, and you were involved in an operation that the CIA ended up blowing. You returned to CIA headquarters, and you were up for both a promotion and for a plum assignment. Tell us what happened then. Why did you not go back overseas?
Well, with regard to that Iranian operation that I was involved in, it was called Operation Merlin, and it was designed to thwart the Iranian nuclear program by giving them plans, giving the Iranians plans to a nuclear weapon, but the plans would have a flaw. So if the Iranians used the plans to make a nuclear weapon, it wouldn't work. And the theory being that it would set their program back a number of years. Well, I was given assurances that the plans would not, the flaw in the plans would not be detected by anyone. They were worked on by one of our national labs here in the U.S. So I was given all sorts of assurances that this was a safe program and it wouldn't help the Iranians get weapons. Well, as we were going through and getting close to launch, the individual who I was working with to approach the Iranians with the plans, when he first saw the plans, he immediately detected the flaw. So science being what it is, anybody sees a flaw, they're going to try to fix it. And make it maybe even better than it would have been before. So when the individual was able to detect the flaw immediately, all sorts of alarms and bells and whistles went off in my head that this isn't going to help the thwart the Iranians. It's actually going to help them develop a nuclear weapon. So I made my concerns known to my supervisors, even all the way up through other channels within the CIA. And the response basically was, as I was told at the meeting where we learned about that the individual could see the flaw, was to shut up. I took my concerns to the Senate Intelligence Committees with really no attention and really no care. It was a CIA operation, and as long as the CIA had its stamp of approval, no one cared.
My goodness. I want to ask you also about your racial discrimination lawsuit. What happened there is a problem for every intelligence community employee who's been wronged. You had a legitimate lawsuit, but it was dismissed by the district court after the CIA invoked the state secrets privilege. You appealed to the Federal Court of Appeals, but that court upheld the dismissal, saying, quote, there is no way for Sterling to prove employment discrimination without exposing at least some classified details of the covert employment that gives context to his claim, unquote. What this clearly means is that you may have been discriminated against. You probably were discriminated against. But to allow you to have your day in court like every other American would have might expose secrets. That has to be colossally frustrating. You never got your day in court. What happened next?
Absolutely. Well, even just to add a little more context on that, I mean, I'm a lawyer. I went to law school. I knew the law. I knew what my options were. I knew what protections I should have had under the Constitution. And for a court, one, for the CIA to invoke state secrets privilege to hide their discrimination, they weren't saying I wasn't discriminated against. They were saying that they didn't want to have to expose it or have it fall under scrutiny. For an appeals court to uphold that decision, it basically said, and it just threw everything I learned in law school out the door, that a black man fighting for his civil rights is a threat to the national security mm-hmm. of this country. It stung then, it certainly stings, because that's an affront to the very nature of the Constitution. I did not sign on to the CIA with the thought that I'm giving up my civil rights. And what's also important to understand is there was no argument about the merits of my discrimination case against the CIA. They just did not want to have their discrimination exposed under the light of justice. And so it was tossed aside without even getting to the merits of the case.
Another thing that was happening in the background throughout this time was that the CIA was intercepting emails that you were exchanging with then New York Times journalist James Risen. Risen was covering the story of your discrimination suit, but the CIA alleged, without offering any proof, that you were passing Risen secrets about Iran. The CIA never offered any proof that this was happening. In fact, there were disgruntled former CIA officers who otherwise would have been prime suspects, but they hadn't embarrassed the CIA by accusing them of racial discrimination. You didn't know, of course, that you were being investigated under the Espionage Act, and by the time you found out, the deck was already stacked against you. You were finally charged with multiple counts of espionage in the notorious Eastern District of Virginia. A disclaimer, I was also charged with multiple counts of espionage in the Eastern District of Virginia at about the same time. And like you, I hadn't committed espionage, and the charges against me were eventually dropped. But you were tougher than I was. You decided to fight them. That was an incredibly courageous move. Tell us what that was like. What did it feel like as you were going through that experience?
Well, the initial shock was that I was the only purpose I had in mind joining the CIA and exposing a flawed program was I was trying to serve my country, save lives, right, if you will. But then to be accused of violating the Espionage Act, essentially is looking at the face of it, spying or providing enemy secrets, providing our country secrets to an enemy. To be charged with that after trying to stand up for my rights as a citizen, trying to work for the CIA, and to be shown the door essentially by being accused of being a spy was a horrible experience. It made me question everything about how my country viewed me. But I was determined that I wasn't going to bow down to any sort of aggression like this. I knew I was never going to plead guilty to something that I did not do, and that certainly was the case here. I did not provide anyone any secrets with regard to anything that I worked on for or with the CIA. Yet, in the throes of being fired, as a result of my discrimination suit and having the nerve to stand up to them, I know there is a feeling that they had of retaliation. There is no vengeance like CIA vengeance. It runs deep and it runs long. Yes, and any opportunity that they have to go after anyone perceived as an enemy, they're going to take it. They took that opportunity with me. Yet I, again, having my legal background, I knew what I was facing. Yet I had a belief in truth, that the truth would come out and that the criminal justice system would work the way it's supposed to. It did not. I have no regrets about standing up for myself. I will never have any regrets about that. I do have a regret of how the system treated me and really overall how it treats whistleblowers in general. I think that is the crime here.
Agreed. You underwent something of a show trial, Jeffrey. Even former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice came out to testify against you. But the CIA had to admit that it had no actual evidence that you had committed a crime. They had some metadata showing that you were in touch with Risen, which you were clear about, but you argued that the two of you were talking about your racial discrimination lawsuit. Nonetheless, you were convicted on a whole bunch of counts, this, of course, being the Eastern District of Virginia, after all. And even though you faced more than 100 years in prison, you got 3.5. That in and of itself, to me, is evidence of your innocence. There is evidence that the CIA was upset with the sentence. The Federal Bureau of Prisons claims that it tries to keep prisoners as close as family, as close as possible to their families. But you were sent all the way across the country to a prison in Colorado. And it was from this prison that you launched your appeal. Tell us about those experiences.
Well, one thing I want to say also about the Eastern District of Virginia, I mean, that is also the same court that decided I, as a black man, had no civil rights.
And that's right.
Me standing up for myself was a threat to national security. So it was a revolving door of going to the same place that had no regard for me as a citizen of this country. But going through that trial, you're absolutely right. It was nothing more than a show trial. The CIA had absolutely no evidence to present. They had to admit that they didn't investigate anyone else other than me, even in the face of damning evidence against others. We had an individual on the stand who was part of the Senate Intelligence Committee, part of the group that I spoke to with my concerns about Operation Merlin. That individual, shortly after the interview with me, when I was using the proper channels to complain about classified operations, that individual was fired for leaking information, classified information from the Senate Intelligence Committee to a reporter. And oh, by the way, that reporter happened to be the same one that I was accused of leaking information to, James Risen. Yet that individual wasn't questioned, wasn't investigated at all. Yet, as you said, they collected every email that could possibly come from any computer I used, as well as Risen, as well as others. But I was the only focus of their investigation. So going through that show trial was, it was a literal joke, if you will. The prosecution tried every move, every measure that they could try to keep me from looking at evidence. One of the only clear valid thoughts the judge has was that they couldn't prevent me from seeing classified information that I had already had access to. So that threw their case out of the window a little bit. But what they really ended up doing, the only thing that that court proved beyond a reasonable doubt was that I was black, was that I was an African-American. There was a whole parade of CIA officers, white officers, paraded on the stand to say, yes, I'm a good CIA officer. No, I did not leak classified information. Not a bit of evidence about anything that I had done, supposedly. No support for any of their allegations. Yet they were able to prove to that I was a black American. And as we unfortunately know in this country, sometimes that's all that is needed.
We're going to take a short break and return for the second half of our conversation with famed CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling. You're watching The Whistleblowers. Stay tuned.
Mr. Biden goes to Kyiv. The U.S. president's unannounced trip can be interpreted in a number of ways. Is one of them an act of desperation to keep Washington's coalition of the willing together just before the anticipated Russian offensive? We will soon find out.
I look forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence as own existence.
Обстреливают, конечно, украинские войска.
Что горело? Трупы валяются, людей военных, что дети, они плачут, мы под пулями шли.
Националисты просто вот дома рушили, людей просто мясом с них делали.
Еще это время азовцы просто прятались за нами. Мы были жвачки на их, и все.
Как только уничтожаются неонацисты, украинская армия просто сложит оружие.
Украина говорит, наш Донбасс. Почему он свой Донбасс, вот Украина, била? Сколько лет? Издевалась?
Да или их так настроили, или, я не знаю, такая вот, что они озлоблены, то, что вот именно за нас заступились.
Российские войска нас освободили. Там это ужас, я не могу разговаривать. Там жизни не было.
Там все сгорело везде, к вам пешком тут шли, да, ну. Плачу, потому что рады, то, что это уже все прошло наконец-то.
Мы, наверное, тоже настрадались за 8 лет. Рано или поздно этому всему должен прийти конец.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. We're speaking with CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling. Jeffrey, we're talking about your odyssey through the federal court in the Eastern District of Virginia. You were convicted of espionage despite the fact that there was no actual evidence against you, and you were sentenced to 3.5 years in prison. One of the things that has been difficult for me to understand, and I'm sure you would agree, is that James Risen, the New York Times reporter whom you were accused of passing classified information to, had only to say the words, "Jeffrey Sterling was not my source," and the case would have likely been over. But he refused to do that. Why? Did Risen ever explain himself to you? Did he ever offer you an apology?
No, he's never explained himself to me, and I've never felt that he needed to explain anything to me. Mr. Risen did not start that train that eventually landed me in prison. This was a vendetta. This was a purpose, government with a purpose to come after me, to teach me a lesson and send a message. And as far as I'm concerned, yes, you're absolutely right. It should have been over the moment that Mr. Risen said that I was not his source, because I certainly was not his source. But then the entire ordeal turned into, as the press was labeling it, the Risen case, because there was the concern, the issue of whether the government under the Obama administration would put a reporter, a journalist, in jail, in prison, for refusing to testify about his sources. Well, it became the Risen case. I became a spectator of my own criminal trial. And that was a bit disheartening, but I couldn't and would not lay any of that blame onto Mr. Risen, because no matter what he had said, no matter what he was going to say, the government was hell-bent on at least sending me to trial. One, mm-hmm. to show how the CIA does great operations, and two, to send a message to anyone who has the nerve to stand up and say no to government wrongdoing. And the interesting thing on that is, the government did have the opportunity, thanks once again to the Eastern District of Virginia, to call Mr. Risen, to force him to testify, yet they chose not to. I think they did so in the sense that they knew they had a card up their sleeve that they could use, and it was going to be used throughout. And I think it was that, you know, a black man sitting at a defendant's table. I think our criminal justice system has proven that that is one of the easiest things to do. That's one of the easiest convictions to get. And given the atmosphere, the environment, being tried in the Eastern District of Virginia with any concerns of national security, most individuals from the jury pool were connected in some way to some organization or some agency within the U.S. intelligence community. So there's already that stacked deck against you. But with regard, and that's a long way to come back around, but Mr. Risen, I don't have any animosity to him, towards him for anything. He didn't start the process. I was not his source. Is he obligated to protect me in that sense? That's a debate that I guess can still wage on. Yet this entire ordeal was started by the U.S. government, and the fact that they didn't call him, because, you know, as a lawyer, you put on your best evidence. But the fact that they didn't call him, one, I think is a testament to the fact that they had no evidence, and they really didn't care. Mm-hmm. They didn't care whether they called him or not. The purpose and goal was Jeffrey Sterling and to come after me. Mm-hmm. And that's either by breaking me financially through a long protracted trial. And again, we're talking about a situation for me from the beginning of my discrimination issues with the CIA to the trial. And in prison, you know, we're talking almost 20 years.
Right.
So their purpose was beyond Mr. Risen.
Jeffrey, you wrote an absolutely outstanding book about your life and experiences called Unwanted Spy, The Persecution of an American Whistleblower. I was proud to write a blurb for the book. And the truth is that I read it in one sitting, which I told you at the time. I couldn't put it down. It's available, of course, at Amazon and wherever books are sold. The reviews were universally outstanding. What was the response to your book among your former colleagues at the CIA? Have you heard anything from any of them?
Actually, maybe a two or three, actually. I haven't, as you can talk to as well, when you stand up and you're considered a outcast as a CIA, others at the CIA will shun you as well. Guilt by association runs rampant at the CIA. I've only had maybe one or two former colleagues who have read the book and congratulated me on it for telling the truth about how things are at the CIA. But universally though, I haven't had much contact with any of the people I really considered friends when I was at the agency. The fear of being also labeled a disgruntled employee by having any association with me, I think shied them away from me. But to the book, and thank you for your kind comments on the book, but the most interesting reaction to the book, I think, came from the CIA itself. Again, as it was established in the court, I follow the rules. So as I was writing the book, I had to submit information to the publications review board so that they could make sure I wouldn't divulge any classified information. Of course, there were many aspects of the book that they had a problem with. So I promptly sent them the trial transcript, which basically laid out my entire career at the CIA. Mm-hmm. And there was not much for them to argue about. So going through the process, it took only about 3 months to get publication review approval. And that is pretty unheard of if you actually care to follow the rules. But we know so many other authors who don't even bother with it yet or not.
That's very impressive, actually. My first book took me 9 months to write. It took me 22 months to get it cleared by the CIA's Publications Review Board. They first gave me what's called a blanket rejection, where they said that literally everything I had written in the book was classified, and therefore I was prohibited from moving forward with it. And I had to write back and say, look, it's not classified that I was born in Pennsylvania. It's not classified that my ex-wife spoke Greek. It's not classified that I got a degree in Middle Eastern studies. And so that was the first salvo in a fight that lasted just short of 2 years. I know what you went through. I wanted to ask you, too, about some of the fallout. You took the CIA's best shot, and you survived. What advice would you give would-be whistleblowers, especially in the national security arena, who are considering going public with evidence of wrongdoing? What would you tell them?
I would tell them to, stay true to yourself. I mean, if they're just because you're part of this massive machine that is the U.S. government, I mean, do not look at your job through the lens of the fear or the lens of apprehension about what can happen to you if you stand up. Individuals stand up, that stand up to aggression, that stand up to wrongdoing is what has made this country great and keeps making it great, because there are people who have the nerve to get up and say enough or stop. So my advice to any would-be whistleblower, I mean, and the thing is, no one sets out to be a whistleblower.
That's right.
I mean, no one says, I'm gonna blow the whistle today, darn it. No, they get to a point, and we all have our own triggers of where we can see wrongdoing and we decide to do something. And my advice is stay with that feeling. Stick with your gut on wanting to come forward. There is going, especially on the government side, there is going to be anger thrown at you. There is going to be every legal method possible to be thrown at you, but stick to your guns. Because for me, the main thing that helped me go through all of this is that I was able to look myself in the mirror. If I looked and I could see and accept and like who I saw, then I was going to continue whatever course, that was going to be laid for me. If I had bowed down, if I had not blown the whistle about racial discrimination at the CIA or about how foolhardy Operation Merlin was, I never would have been able to live with myself after that. I wouldn't have liked who I saw in the mirror. So for any person who could potentially be a whistleblower, stick with what you know, stick with your feeling, because that'll carry you through whatever hardships that you'll face.
I would like to thank our guest, CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling, for joining us today, and thanks to our viewers. I'm John Kiriakou. Please join us again next week for another episode of The Whistleblowers.